Adam, I want you to kick it off and talk a little bit. In an op-ed that you wrote last year, you pointed out that Oklahoma is actually one of the country's three fastest growing prison systems in the country. So what's behind this continued growth? And you can you describe also some of the types of sentencing practices that contributed to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for the question, Allison. And one of the main reasons why Oklahoma's prison system is growing and continues to grow is because of 85% crimes. And those are certainly not popular to talk about. Those are some of the worst, most violent crimes that we have deemed are worth the offender spending 85% of their sentence mandatory in prison. But the impact of those prison sentences over long periods of time is that more and more people have to spend longer and longer in prison. So that's one thing. When you look particularly from 2014 to 2015, one of the reasons why our growth was so significant is because former Director Patton at the time decided to clear out county jails. So the way the system works, for those of you that don't know, is when someone's sentenced and convicted, they wait in county jails for a bed within the state prison system. And while they wait at the county jails are essentially charging the state prison system for every day that they're there. They're paid a per diem rate. So at the time, there was about 1,600 people across the state waiting in county jails. In 2013, we spent, out of the Department of Corrections budget, $22 million out to county jails for people waiting to come into the DOC system. One of the reasons at the time is that the only way the Department of Corrections knows that somebody is waiting to come into the state system is when they receive a document. It's called the judgment and sentencing document. And right now, that's all paper. It's all paper-based. So at the time, there was no requirement on when that document needed to be sent in. So you really had no way of knowing that somebody was even waiting until you got the bill. Sometimes it was days, sometimes it was weeks, sometimes it was months. And we had, you know, the Department of Corrections was forced to pay that money to the counties. So Director Patton at the time said, we're going to clear all those people out. So he said, direct the Department of Corrections to identify and essentially create an additional 1,400 beds within the existing state prison system. That's without building a single new facility. He said, create the beds. So what we did is we took our facilities and we identified spaces like day rooms, and I'll try and wrap this up, day rooms, common areas, and we put beds in them. We doubled, triple, and quadruple booked cells. So now when we talk about 119% capacity, that's 119% of operational capacity, which includes those additional beds. When you want to really get down to what is that actual number, that's called the rated capacity. That's the capacity of these buildings when they were designed and built to hold a certain number of beds. That number, we don't know, is probably closer in the range of 150 or 160% of capacity. So that's one reason why our prison system grew so significantly from 2014 to 2015. And the problem is that we're already back up to, fiscal 16 is not even over, we're already back up to 900 people waiting in the county jails. And we can't create another 1,400 beds. So what do you do? So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why it grew so significantly, and that's one of the reasons why we're in such a bind right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Jonathan, now I can remember during my time at the Office of State Finance that, and we heard Speaker Steele talk about this, that the Department of Corrections budget was always one of the major drivers of spending. This was especially difficult during the several years that we had to cut budgets or cut spending, and I mean real spending cuts. Talk a little bit, do you want to add a little bit to what the speaker's comments were for really what this means for the health of the state?
Well, you know, there's two factors that are extremely important when considering the impact of our failed corrections policy. There's the immediate state impact, but then there's also the significant income loss that happens to our economy when we take productive citizens and place them in prison. So the first thing to remember is that we've seen massive growth in our prison system. It's been approximately 440% growth over the last few decades. And, you know, obviously Oklahomans have not gotten that much worse. It's definitely been a change in policy in Oklahoma. The other thing that's significant to remember, though, is that we're now to the point in Oklahoma where we spend nearly $500 million on just state-level appropriations for our corrections facilities alone. To give you an idea of what that impact is, though, approximately 50%, 52%, depending on who you're talking to, of that amount is spent on nonviolent offenders. So the real effect of that is that Oklahoma taxpayers are in a position where They're spending over $230 million a year for the incarceration of people who would better serve the economy. Just because I'm a CPA and I'm a nerd, to give you an idea of this, the real-world impact, the per capita income in Oklahoma is right at approximately $43,000. When you consider the fact that of the roughly 28,000 people that are in prison, if they had not been in prison and if they had just earned half the per capita income level that the typical Oklahoman earns, that's another $306 million in income generation that our Oklahoma economy is going without. And that's not considering economic multiplier effects or any of those other issues. And so it's a real challenge for us. Particularly, we're seeing it an area where the speaker was very involved in our DHS system and Medicaid. Oklahoma's Medicaid budget grew from approximately $700 million in 2004 to $1.9 billion for what the portion that the state's responsible for. A direct cause in that growth is what happens when we take people that happen to commit a nonviolent offense and put them in prison, and then taxpayers are forced to foot the bill for their children who now need daycare assistance and their children who now need government-sponsored health care. So it's a real economic problem, which is secondary to the human element problem that it poses as well.
Yeah, I think that's great. You know, when we talk about the costs of of incarceration, it's easy to get fixated just on the cost to the taxpayers, but there is a lot more than that, both direct and indirect. So, Gene, let me turn to you. I think we all agree that we want our criminal justice system to keep our communities safe, but do longer prison sentences really do that?
Sure. So we heard the statistic that even though Oklahoma has been incarcerating more and more people, we actually haven't seen any drop in crime rates. And it's worth thinking a little bit about why that might be. And what research has really shown is that long, very harsh sentences do not tend to prevent crime, because the type of people who tend to commit crime, one, don't tend to be long-term thinkers. They tend to be more impulsive. Perhaps they have a drug addiction. Perhaps they have mental illness. And they may not even realize the severity of the sentence for whatever it is they get in trouble for. And then putting them into jail for a very long time doesn't turn them into the kind of people who aren't going to make those same mistakes again, because they spend all this time in prison, as has been talked about already, in an environment where it can be very dangerous. They don't have a lot of services because a lot of the training and a lot of the drug treatment and mental health treatment has already been cut in the budget crunch that we're in. And then they spend all that time in prison. We have very low parole rates, so they spend almost their entire sentence in prison, and then they go directly back out on the streets, again, without any kind of assistance or even guidance of them what to do with their lives. And an alternative to that that can save money and protect public safety much more effectively is, one, yes, we want to punish crime, but you do it in a way where there's a swift punishment, and then it doesn't turn into put them in prison and throw away the key. It turns into, okay, we've got you, and now we're going to reintroduce you slowly to the community in a supervised way, but that embeds you within a community that makes sure you have the contacts and makes sure you know how to get employment, and then make sure that you keep the employment by monitoring through an effective parole system. And these kinds of programs that have been shown to work in lots of other places are much, much more effective at preventing crime and protecting public safety than what we're doing here.
And how about the cost of those kinds of programs? How does that compare with incarceration?
Mm-hmm. So there is a cost, absolutely. But if you try to tack it all on at the end of a sentence, then you're paying more. If you parole folks and you provide these services within the community, then you're saving the money on the back end of that sentence that you would have to go to incarceration, which in Oklahoma on average is about $20,000 per person per year. And the parole and community services can cost in general around $5,000. So already you're getting those savings, but only if you're doing it as part of the sentence and not trying to add it on to the sentence, do you actually save taxpayer money.
Thank you. So Lauren, let's turn to some of your work now. How do Oklahoma's sentencing laws compare with other states?
I think that the panelists here have kind of shown that, you know, Oklahoma sentencing laws, they're pretty harsh. I know that they have a lot of mandatory minimum sentencing laws, which mean that when you're convicted of a crime that carries a mandatory minimum sentence, you have to serve that full minimum before you're eligible for release. And Oklahoma, I think, is one of the few states that still requires a mandatory minimum prison sentence for drug possession offenses. So it's pretty harsh, and I think that its incarceration rate reflects the type of punishments that are routinely handed down here. But I think if we're looking at Oklahoma in context now, this exciting sort of reform moment that we're, or you all are experiencing here, I'm an outsider, so I'm going to stop using we're. But generally, I mean, it sort of fits in with how other states have started to reexamine their sentencing laws. Now, Oklahoma does have some pretty harsh sentencing laws for nonviolent offenses, and again, its prison population reflects that. Less than half of its prison population, 48.3%, and these are 2014 statistics, are violent offenders in Oklahoma. The majority are nonviolent. 26% are drug offenders, 23% are other nonviolent, and then there's about 3% alcohol-related offenders. But I think that now that we're in this reform movement, the types of laws that Oklahoma is starting to look at and reexamine are those that have been applied to nonviolent offenders, and that's been sort of the general trend across the country. Some of the states that I work in Florida, they're starting to do the same thing. They have budget problems. Their prison population is the second largest in the country. 109,000 people are incarcerated. And they're starting to look at, you know, maybe some of these laws that we passed are having unintended consequences. They're leading to nonviolent offenders serving longer sentences without really a public safety benefit. So I can just go over a couple of states that have enacted reforms. Just to put this whole issue into context, because while it's encouraging that Oklahoma is starting to look at this, like I've mentioned, there are several states, particularly southern states, and as Mr. Steele mentioned earlier, Texas really leading the way on this reform movement, that could serve as models for Oklahoma when we're reexamining some of these issues here. So I'll just quickly go through a few states. South Carolina in 2010, they eliminated the disparity between crack cocaine sentences. They made first-time drug possession offenses, petty drug possession, a misdemeanor offense. They eliminated mandatory minimums for drug offenses. And their prison population, and I do want to put this into context as far as we always talk about, you know, we want to reduce the prison population, but what kind of effect has that had on crime rates? So South Carolina, since 2010, they've seen their prison population decrease by 12%, and their crime rate has also decreased by 12%, which shows that it's possible to reduce the number of prisoners in a particular state and crime simultaneously, which is an important point when we're reexamining some of these laws in Oklahoma. I think that one's instinct is to think that we're releasing prisoners, there might be a spike in violent crime, but other states that have reduced their prison population, they haven't seen it. And I'll quickly run through a couple others, just general reforms. Mississippi, 2014, they had some reforms, just comprehensive low-level drug offense reforms. Georgia, they increased their theft statute from $500 to $1,500, which, by the way, their theft statute was set in 1982 and was never reexamined or, you know, accounted for inflation since then. They had comprehensive drug reforms in 2012. Mississippi. Alabama, they had their Justice Reinvestment Initiative in 2015. And Utah had big reforms in 2014. They made all first and second drug possession offenses, misdemeanors. And they made 241 misdemeanor offenses to civil citations. And they're going to redirect all the savings that they're seeing from prison into rehabilitation programs and public safety programs. So I know I've taken up a lot of time, but I think that, you know, seeing how every state has unique issues and every state has different problems, but I think that seeing that there are some states that have led on this issue, particularly southern states, I think that it's encouraging for Oklahoma to show that it is possible to reduce prison populations in a safe way that could potentially lead to reductions in violent crime as well. So.
Thank you. So you mentioned a lot of the work that states are doing on reducing sentencing for drug crimes. And so I was at a breakfast this morning with Jonathan, and Jonathan, you were talking about the difference between if you as a person, not you as an individual, went and got drunk and did something, or if you
purely hypothetical
because you are a nerd,
yeah.
or if you had smoked pot. Can you want to walk the audience through to understand really the disparity in the system?
Well, so to give you an idea of one of the huge challenges that we have in Oklahoma, right now in Texas, a typical property crime is that would classify you for a felony would be $2,500. In Oklahoma, that number is a mere $500. And what we discussed with lawmakers this morning is you think about the kinds of accidental mistakes one might make that would cause $500 worth of harm. You walk outside the Thunder after they win a close game on New Year's Eve night, and you bump the side mirror on a Mercedes, and you're intoxicated while you've done that. And I know it sounds really descriptive that I would be able to describe that, but I promise you that's never happened to me. And consider the effects of what would happen. So you would immediately, if you had a very entrepreneurial DA who would be able to charge you for a property crime that was exceeding well more than $500, and then that person would be in the very difficult position of dealing with answering to an employer why they have a felony for vandalizing a car. There's other issues that are a challenge as well. When you consider what is happening for many of these individuals, they are put in a position where they make a very small mistake and they prefer, you know, some sort of other drug or paraphernalia as opposed to having an alcohol problem. But very similarly situated mistakes result in very disparate impact for individuals. And it has a huge impact on us in Oklahoma and has a really huge impact on family breakdown here in our state.
So just a general question for the panel then, you know, in a conservative state like Oklahoma with regard to drug sentencing, are these ideas controversial? How should we be thinking about them? Adam?
Are the ideas of sentencing reform controversial?
With regard to drug sentencing.
Drug reform. Sentencing.
Yeah, so...
I think that on a certain scale, you know, if you talk about legalization, that's certainly going to be controversial in Oklahoma. I think when you really break down, and as Lauren put into context, what are we doing in comparison to other states, given the problem that we're facing, I don't think it's that controversial, especially when you're talking about crimes that are nonviolent. Not to say that substance abuse or addiction is not... doesn't harm other people, because it certainly does. But it's not something that we would consider a violent offense. It's things that we're treating those people the same as people who do commit violent crimes, people who we are afraid of, people who do need to be kept away from society. And especially when you consider on the other end, when they come out of prison, the impact, those people are treated the same. They're now carrying, like we've talked about, the stigma of a felony, all the impacts of a felony conviction and a prison sentence are the same for somebody who's really wronged our society, needed to be in prison, and somebody who maybe could have been better served somewhere else for less money and produced better outcomes. That, to me, doesn't seem controversial. I know that typically in Oklahoma and in other conservative states, it is, because we don't want to be viewed as soft on crime. And what I would say is that idea came about in the 80s and 90s when we had a drug epidemic, when we needed to do something to address these problems. And we did. We made these sentences longer. We made punishments harsher. And now we've had a 30-year social experiment of what that produces. And I think we've got to recognize that we're at a critical point in time where we need to recognize that we've got the results. The results are in. Do we continue doing this or do we do something else? And I don't think that that decision point is controversial.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the incentives were right. I mean, the reasons were very, very well intentioned. But now we know we have terrible collateral consequences, huge damages to family. And for those econ geeks like myself, we know that there's been terrible cost to the economy as well. Jane, do you want to add anything to that?
And I think that pretty well covers it. I think, honestly, Oklahomans are more ready for this than we're given credit for in a lot of places, in a lot of ways. It really is amazing every time we've written about this issue on our website and just the number of comments that come in. And it really is at the point where our incarceration rate is so high that so many people have been affected and so many people share these really, really touching, hard, hard personal stories of their family member who's in prison and they feel like, you know, they did something wrong, but they've been punished very harshly and they love this person and they don't see any way to help them. And I think it's something that has extended deep, deep into communities, and Oklahomans get it, and Oklahomans are realizing that there's a possibility for change.
Yeah, and Allison, if I can just jump in really quickly to support Gene's point, there was a study conducted in the state in 2006, and they estimated that 1 in 12 Oklahomans have been incarcerated or were on probation for a felony conviction. 1 in 12.
Wow, that's stunning.
Yeah, Allison, I'm just going to jump in agreeing with what Gene said. You know, there's a funny thing that us policy analysts like a term or a phrase that we like to use, which is lawmakers are lagging indicators. They're generally way behind the public on an issue. And we're seeing that right now in Oklahoma. When you look at the various polls, what's interesting is that there's right now Oklahomans are having and embracing corrections reform at a greater rate than even some in blue states. And I think that we need to ask the question, why is that? You know, when you think about being a conservative or red state, look at states like Texas. I think no one would argue that Texas would be considered more red or the kind of state you might want to be if you're a red state. Or even the state of Utah. I think no one could argue that there's a state that has more of a religious-based background than the state of Utah, yet they've seen the benefit of this. I think one of the things that we have to remember is that each generation is always faced with the decision to reevaluate what generations had done before it. And we always have the personal responsibility to improve on the grave mistakes that people made before us. And I can think of no greater or better conservative idea than to admit when things don't work and improve those things to help the most vulnerable.
Yeah, you know, thinking about lawmakers as lagging indicators, I think a lot of that really is lawmakers sort of need permission from their constituents to take actions, especially when you are correcting mistakes or kind of doing things that could be seen as controversial or reversing course. Gene, I want to turn back to you. Now, you've done a lot of work on what we talked about, the collateral consequences of criminal conviction. And I wondered if you could, you know, talk through without, we've mentioned some of them, but I wondered if you could just take some time to talk about what the lifetime consequences of being an ex-felon are today in Oklahoma.
Yeah, so collateral consequences are basically all of the things that come attached with having a felony record besides the direct punishment of going to prison. And this is important for Oklahoma because we charge a lot of things as felonies here that are misdemeanors in almost every other state. So regardless of how much time you spend in prison, having that felony mark is a life sentence. And what that means is that you can be denied public benefits like student loans and nutrition assistance and public housing. You can be ineligible for state licenses to get a job in numerous occupations, and way beyond that, you can be excluded from many other jobs by employers who won't hire anyone with a felony record. Many of these national firms who have a policy where they don't hire felons but don't understand necessarily in Oklahoma that that actually catches a whole lot more people under a net than you do get in most other places. We have restricted people from getting driver's licenses with the felony record until they've paid off numerous fines and fees, but at the same time, they need to drive to get to most jobs. And so we have this situation where they can't get to a job until they pay, and they can't pay until they get the job. And what this has done is that this is creating a large and permanent class of people who are really cut off from the American dream, cut off from our communities. And that should be, I think, really concerning for our health, for all of us as a society.
And so I think that, so correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Oklahoma pass some revisions to occupational licensing mm-hmm. laws last year? Maybe you could walk through those really quickly and if you're seeing any impacts, positive impacts from those, or is it too early?
It is too early to kind of know the direct impact, and it's difficult because a lot of boards really have discretion, and what Oklahoma passed last year was really refining the language to say, for example, the Board of Cosmetology don't deny people the ability to become a cosmetologist unless their crime was directly related to the profession or poses a threat to public safety. And so it covered that and several other professions. And it's hard to see hard numbers on that, but just the message having that out there that these jobs are available is important because there really is a lot of demoralization where they've applied to tens and dozens and hundreds of jobs and just not even gotten the chance to get in the door and have an interview. And just to know that there are employers that do hire felons, these people get, when the word kind of gets out that an employer can be felon-friendly, they get waves after waves of applications because the demand is so high for people who want to work, who want to be part of society. And so just kind of sending that message out there to employers as well as to people with felony records that it is okay.
So I'm going to have shameless self-promotion here. So my organization, you know, when you fill out a job application, you have to check this little box that says if you have ever been convicted of a felony. And so there's a movement called Drop the Box. I think that's it, right? Drop the Box? Ban the Box. So my organization has banned the box, and we don't ask that question. Yay!
And to that point, I mean, there are many organizations that do that. I mean, there are over 118 cities and municipalities. Several states have banned the box. Organizations like Hobby Lobby, Walmart, Target, Bed Bath & Beyond have all taken the felony question off of job applications.
Yeah, that's great. Is that something that the state here can do or local governments?
Absolutely. So that was one of the recommendations that came out of the governor's programs and reentry subcommittee that went on last year. But really what it does is, you know, it doesn't prevent employers from inquiring about a felony conviction in the interview process. All it does is, you know, I use this example sometimes. If you're a small business owner and you've got 10 job applications and two of them have checked a box that say they're a convicted felon, who are the first two applicants that you're going to get rid of right off the bat? And the problem is those people are probably well qualified. And even if they aren't, should they not have an opportunity to explain, here's what my felony was, here's what I was convicted for, here's how many years it's been since I was convicted and served time in prison, here's how I've paid my debt to society, and here's the person that I am today, and here's why I'm qualified for this job. And the reality is that when they have to check that box, they simply don't have the opportunity to explain that.
Yeah, right. So let's talk a little bit about your experience working on the sentencing. It was a commission?
Yep, a committee.
So can you talk a little bit about the work that you did, how you brought people together, and the reforms that you proposed?
Absolutely. So this kind of touches on one of the big factors that have contributed to what we're experiencing today, some of the bills that we're seeing in the legislature right now. But basically it was a process that Governor Fallon initiated at the beginning of last year It was a committee called the Criminal Justice Reform Steering Committee. It was chaired by the governor. He had the speaker and the pro tem, director of Department of Corrections, commissioner of Department of Mental Health, and the attorney general. So those people were at the table, and they said, how can we work on this issue? They formed four subcommittees, so sentencing, programs and reentry, treatment, and then policing. And so each of those subcommittees produced recommendations that are now in different forms, bills in this legislative session. And I noticed we're about out of time, but I mean, there are a few different reforms that have come out. When you heard the governor talk about in the State of the State address, some of the sentencing reforms that she talked about were a direct result of the sentencing subcommittee, which was chaired by former DA from Tulsa County. He's Tim Harris. He was a DA for almost 15 years in Tulsa County, had three different DAs on it, and public defenders and private attorneys. And so these recommendations that came out of these subcommittees represent great steps forward for the state of Oklahoma when it comes to criminal justice reform.
So if I could give you just another minute then, were there some particular reforms that came out of that work on sentencing that you think the audience ought to take away today to think about?
Absolutely. So we've already talked about one of them, which is the property crime threshold. So there's a bill. There was a recommendation that came out of the sentencing subcommittee that said we can adjust our current threshold, which is $500. It's been that way for the last 14 years. We can move that to $1,000. There are 20 other states in the last 11 years that have raised that threshold to well above $1,000. So Oklahoma by no means is an outlier from that point. Another one is adjusting the mandatory minimum sentences for simple drug possession. So right now, for your first felony offense is 2 to 10 years, for your second felony offense is 4 to 20, and for your third felony offense is 6 to 20. So the recommendation that came out of the sentencing subcommittee unanimously recommended was to adjust those from 0 to 5, 0 to 10, and 0 to 15. And what you have is you've essentially eliminated a mandatory prison sentence. Now, it's not always mandatory. You're not always going to go to prison if you're charged with a felony drug possession offense. But what it does is it takes away that possibility, and that's what's important. Another one, which I think is really key, and Gene was talking about some of the collateral consequences, is a bill that would expand the availability of something that we have in Oklahoma called a provisional driver's license. So for people who have had their driver's license taken away as a result of a felony conviction, this would allow them to enter into a payment plan with the Department of Public Safety and with counties where they can actually get a driver's license, where they can go to and from work, where they can take their kids to school, where they can go to church, and actually have an opportunity to try and pay back some of these fines and fees, which often amount to in the hundreds if not thousands of dollars. That bill was passed in 2013, and one of the recommendations that they made was to focus on allowing counties to enter into payment programs with people who are applying for a provisional driver's license. So those are just a few that
we came
out.
Great, thank you. Yeah. And Lauren, is there anything that you would add to that, given your knowledge of reforms in other states?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think that every state has its own unique issues, and they've come to where they are today from different directions. But honestly, I think that there's a real opportunity for Oklahoma to show some real leadership on this. And I think that, you know, there's just so many different areas that you could reform. I think that starting with the drug sentencing is a good place to start. But I would challenge, like, why keep simple drug possession a felony at all? We're talking about all the collateral consequences of a felony record. And if for someone who just possessed a small amount of drugs because they had an addiction or, you know, for whatever reason, and they didn't hurt anybody and they weren't kingpins or anything like that, why brandish them with a felony record? I think a number of states, including Utah and South Carolina, have moved further on this. That's my big thing. I mean, I don't want to be the outsider coming in and telling people in Oklahoma they need to just tear it all down. Not going to be the crazy libertarian on the panel, although it could be. But I think that, you know, I think that Oklahoma really needs to start asking itself some serious questions as far as why are these laws on the books in the first place? I know that a number of these were enacted with good intentions, but they obviously haven't. There've been some unintended consequences, and I think that we've locked up the wrong type of people for a long time. And I think that we need to ask some serious questions as to how to remedy that situation a little bit beyond what maybe feels comfortable right now.
Allison, if I could jump in and defend the outsider. So I do think that we do need to tear some of it down. If you saw the announcement, the state budget shortfall has now grown from $900 billion to $1.3 billion. So I would suggest that lack of boldness is now not an option for Oklahomans. Oklahomans are already ready for it. So lawmakers should be considering things like working with the Department of Corrections and the Governor's Office and the Pardon and Parole Board to implement a pilot program to go back and look at people that have 5 to 10 year offenses currently in prison and use a analysis to assess those people and see if they're ready and begin to slowly release people early from prison. We no longer have an option to try to continue to pay for the system that we have today. When you look at polling, Oklahomans far prefer spending money on core services that will have a positive impact on the future. They're not interested in future more significant investments in corrections. So looking at things that are going to quickly implement early release are, we don't want to make it all economic, but the fact of the matter is that's where Oklahoma is today. Oklahoma is going to have to cut services somewhere, and I think that the place that we should start is where there's complete agreement in the public and also a great opportunity to improve the future for Oklahomans.
Yeah, thank you. And I was actually going to call on you, and you just made my point or my question, which is, you know, perhaps the silver lining of the budget shortfall, massive budget shortfall, is that some really positive and much bolder reforms are going to be possible. And Gene, before we go to Q&A, and you're raising your hand, I was just going to ask if you had anything you wanted to add, especially in terms of reforms.
Yeah, well, I wanted to add about the potential for saving money. There was some really important comments that the current interim Department of Corrections director made in the newspaper today or yesterday, talking about how you don't really get those savings until you are actually able to close a facility. Because if we just make small changes and we are at 110% capacity instead of 120 or 90 instead of 120, we still have to run that same building. We still have to pay for all of those expenses. And so it really does take some bold action to reduce the population enough that we can take those very large standing expenses off the table.
Is there anything bold in particular that you would throw out on the table as an insider?
I think the things that have been proposed are definitely a good step. I think the ballot initiative that is proposed has been another good step. I think one thing that we really are going to have to talk about that's going to be a much harder conversation is going beyond changes to these low-level crimes, but also looking very closely at paroling even more serious crimes and providing community supervision outside of prison, both because it's more effective for public safety and because it's less expensive. But then to do that, you really have to talk about the people who, when you start describing the crime, a lot of people get the heebie-jeebies and a lot of legislators get the heebie-jeebies really quickly, so it's going to take courage to deal with those issues.
Sounds like courage and education.
Yeah, courage and education.
Okay, great.